भवत्वर्यमा शन्नहिन्द्रो बृहस्पतिः शन्नो विष्णुरुरुक्रमः नमो ब्रह्मणे नमस्ते वायो त्वमेव प्रत्यक्षं ब्रह्मासि त्वमेव प्रत्यक्षं ब्रह्म वदिष्यामि ऋतं वदिष्यामि सत्यं वदिष्यामि तन्मामवतु तद्वक्तारमवतु अवतु माम् अवतु वक्तारम् ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ
Very good. So this evening we continue with the latter part of the second valli, second of the major sections of the Taittiriya Upanishad. The second valli includes some of the most basic teachings of Vedanta, which you see expressed again and again in the teachings of so many great acharyas from Shankaracharya onwards. The teachings of Vedanta, of Advaita Vedanta in particular, taught by Shankaracharya and others, was not invented by them. As I've mentioned before, Shankara didn't create Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta, properly understood, is a truth unfolded by particular methodologies. The truth is universal. Truth, by definition, is universal. What is true here and now must be true everywhere and at all times. Truth is universal. There's nothing unique about the teaching of the Upanishads. Sounds funny to say that, but it's true. In the vision of the ancient rishis, there's nothing unique. Their vision is not unique. After all, Christian mystics have had the same insights. Sufi mystics have had the same insights. Jewish mystics have had the same insights. The mainstream religious people probably haven't had those insights, but the mystical traditions in each one of these religions most certainly have had the same insights. So what the rishis discovered is not unique, but how they presented their discoveries in a way that you could retrace their steps and discover what they discovered. That methodology, what we call prakriya, is unique. And that's what distinguishes Advaita Vedanta as these teaching methodologies. And we can find in the second valli in particular, we see the roots of several of the very important teaching methodologies. We saw in great detail the Panchakosha Prakriya. And then more recently, we've seen this Vyashti Sameshti Prakriya. And if we go through, we could probably find several others that are commonly used. They have their roots in the second valley. So, with this introduction, we're ready now to conclude our study of the second valley. We've come to the ninth and final Anuvaka. Where we begin. And we begin actually with a vakya statement, which we've seen. There we go. I don't know what it's. Don't do that. All right. Correct. Okay. So we begin here with a vakya that we've actually seen earlier, a portion of this vakya we've seen. Remember, each of the anuvakas ends tarap yesha shloko bhavati. And here is a further shloka, a further teaching. So it begins with this teaching yato vacho, which we've seen back in the fourth anuvaka. Let's recite these few lines and then we'll discuss. Repeat after me, please.
Yato vacho nivartante, yato vacho nivartante, aprahapya manasasaha, aprahapya manasa saha anandam brahmano vidvan anandam brahmano vidyan nabibheti kutascha neti nabibheti kutascha neti etagam havavanatapati etagam havavanatapati.
All right. Sound familiar? Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha. This we saw first in the fourth anuvaka. It comes back here once again because it refers to Brahman, the truth of all. And it says that Brahman, which is a reality because of which everything exists, that was the topic of our brief contemplation, it is that yataha, from which vachaha nivartante, words retreat. Words are not able to capture the fullness and completeness of Brahman. Brahman is the source for everything and cannot be expressed in mere words. Of course, you know, I'm smiling because I say that and I think, well, Swamiji, what about the word Brahman? We say Brahman cannot be expressed in words, yet we have a word like Brahman. What does that mean? It's just a word. A word is an abhidhana. It's a name. It's a label. If you get the label, do you really know what the label refers to, what the word refers to? I remember Pooja Swami Dayananda teaching this. Says, he gives this very strange example, and he uses one of his favorite examples is to talk about a gagabugai. You know what is a gagabugai, right? Everyone must know. You don't know what is a gagabugai? Not surprisingly, because he made up the word. So whenever he wants to use a made-up word, the word he chooses is gagabugai. So gagabugai is an abhidhana. It is a name. It is a label for which there's no object. Or at least you don't know what object that label sticks to. Well, the word Brahman is no... Honestly, the word Brahman is no better than gagabugai. If we wanted to be a little bit silly about this, we could say satyam jnanam anantam gagabugai. It's just a word. And words, as we've discussed before, in and of themselves, don't lead. A word doesn't lead you to appreciate the truth. A whole teaching methodology can lead you to the truth, but a mere word cannot lead you to that truth. Therefore, the truth that we seek, Brahman, is that yataha, from which vachaha nivartante, words fall back, words retreat, aprapya, having failed to grasp. Brahman is just a label. So having failed to grasp that truth, words fall back, manasa saha, along with the mind. Our minds use words in an attempt to understand. And you'd agree that we are all intensely verbal people, intensely verbal thinkers. Almost all of your thinking is in the form of words. You know, that may seem very normal, except to appreciate words are not the only possible way of thinking. And a good example is when you experience really strong emotions, not normal emotions, but really strong, either incredibly happy emotions or incredibly sad emotions. In those most intensely powerful emotional moments, there are no words here. Interesting. Even words can't capture the intensity of your emotions. What hope do you have of words capturing the fullness of Brahman? But the point here is that we think mostly verbally. So if our words are not able to grasp Brahman, words retreat along with the mind. Then, when we discussed this vakya back in the fourth anuvaka, we asked then, well, why do we use words? Taittiriya Upanishad is several thousands of words, Sanskrit words, but words. So if we admit words can't reveal the truth we seek, then why are we using a text which is in the form of words? Well, I suppose a snide response to that is, well, what choice do we have? Taittiriya Upanishad and all of our scriptures are in the form of words. But the more profound way of understanding is to ask you to reflect on that very beautiful Arundhati Darshana Nyaya Drishtanta that we gave when we studied this Vakya in the fourth Anuvaka, where you're led from star to star to star to star through that process. We called it a process of guided negation. Words that, remember that, that's right, I'm not going to repeat that whole story about going from star to star to star to star. We discussed that at some length. But just to reflect on what that metaphor represented. If we admit words cannot reveal the reality we want to seek, we want to find, one thing words can do is negate what it's not. Words cannot reveal Brahman, but words can negate what Brahman is not. This is prakriya. This is the methodology. Very profound, very important. And as we discussed long ago, it's not just random negation, but a very, very carefully crafted process of negation, just as you're led from one star to another star, not randomly, but in a very with a very specific direction. In this way, the words of the Upanishad lead us through a process of guided negation to discover the truth we seek. And what is that truth we seek? Anandam Brahmanaha. The Ananda of Brahman. Now, Ananda of Brahma means what? Ananta Brahma. Ananda Brahma, Ananta Brahma. The limitlessness of Brahman. So, Anandam Brahmanaha Vidwan. Vidwan, one who knows. One who knows what? Ananda, Anandam Brahmanaha, one who knows the limitlessness of Brahman. Ananda here cannot mean bliss. One who knows the limitlessness of Brahman. What about that person? Nabibheti kutashchana iti. There's a typo there. Kutashchaneti, it should be. And the Roman is right, but the Devanagari is wrong. Kutashchaneti. The person fears nothing. Oh, let me share this with you. What does that mean? Brahman, the limitlessness of Brahman, or the Ananda of Brahman. Here's Shankaracharya's. He gives a very beautiful description of it. He says, Brahmanaha Anandaha, and I'll skip ahead. You go, it's pretty lengthy. Anything he says, you know, philosophers are known for not, put it the other way, philosophers are not known for their brevity. You go to a library and get out of any book on philosophy. Will it be a book like this? No way. Everything is going to be big. So, I'll skip ahead, and so Shankara explains this Brahmana Ananda as being Atma Bhutam, that which exists as your own true self. Vishaya Vishayi Sambandha Vinirmuktam, that which is not a kind of Ananda or happiness that arises as a result of the connection of object and experiencer. That is, it's not an experience. It's not an experience of happiness or bliss. Vishaya, Vishayi, Sambandha, Vinirmuktam. It's not the result of an experience. Experience, he says, is the combination of object and experiencer. He does say, however, it is swabhavikam. It's your own true nature. It's just as our meditation suggested, the reality of the universe is a reality of you. It's your own true nature. He says, nityam avibhaktam paramanandam. It is nityam, eternal, unchanging. Avibhaktam doesn't have boundaries or limits. It's not that you have a little bit and somebody has more. Avibhaktam, and this is what he calls paramananda. This is that limitlessness of Brahman. Now, gaining this, one who knows this, one who discovers this, becomes free from fear. We saw a similar expression back in the fourth Anuvaka. Why do you become free from fear having discovered this Brahman? It says literally, nabibheti vidwan, the knower of Brahman, nabibheti has no fear, kutahachit, kutashchit, from anything, iti, thus. No fear from anything. And there's actually a trick in this statement. Rishis were, I don't think the rishis mean it like a joke or something, but there's something very interesting in the expression. The rishi says that the wise person fears nothing. And a wise person fears nothing because there's nothing else. There is only Brahman. In order to have fear, we had this discussion before, fear is based on dvaita, duality. You can only be afraid of... Actually, this sounds a little peculiar. Would you be afraid of yourself? If you look in a mirror, oh, actually, it might be scary. I don't know. Early morning, you wonder, oh, gosh, who is that? If you're walking down a dark road at night and you're wondering who's walking behind you, that can be scary. But if it's a sunny day and you see what's behind you is your shadow, you're not going to be afraid because there aren't two things. It's just you. The enlightened person is one who recognizes this is all Brahman. And just for a moment here, reflect, this is not some abstract philosophy. This is all Brahman. So suppose the enlightened person is walking through the wrong neighborhood, wherever it is. Could be in New York, it could be here in New Brunswick, could be anywhere. There are wrong neighborhoods almost everywhere. So imagine our enlightened person walking through the wrong neighborhood. Imagine the kid with a knife coming after him trying to get some money. Now, do you think the enlightened person will have no fear? That's what this verse says. How could the enlightened person have no fear? Well, the enlightened person knows that this body-mind complex is Brahman. That body-mind complex, the one holding the knife, is also Brahman. And if that one catches this one and sticks a knife inside, what happens to Brahman? That being said, the enlightened person will still run as fast as he or she can. If you ask why, the question is really, well, why not? I mean, Brahman is also the running Brahman. There's a long story about that. We'll skip it for today. So the point is, the wisdom of the enlightened person is not some theoretical or abstract thing. It's present all the time. And this is what really distinguishes Vedantic knowledge from what's often given by religious traditions. Usually, religion gives us beliefs. And belief is powerful. Shraddha is very powerful, but not invincible. because you've all known situations where a very religious, pious person, in a moment of crisis, cries out, "Why isn't God answering my prayers?" This I find one of the saddest things in religious life. And it happens frequently, and it happens in every religion, including Hinduism, where people who have been pious and holy, and they've done so much prayer and puja their whole life, and suddenly everything goes wrong. They go on praying and praying and praying. Why isn't God listening to me? Why isn't God answering my prayers? And a person's shraddha, faith, gets shaken. And it's sad, because it's the time they need their faith most. But sadly, they can lose their faith. It can be shaken at these most trying times, most crucial times. On the other hand, you may have heard me comment about this before. In the worst moment of crisis imaginable, just imagine you being in the most horrible situation you can imagine. In such a situation, would there be any doubt or fluctuation in your mind with regard to 2 + 2 = 4? Any doubt? In a really tense moment? Absolutely no doubt. Why? It's knowledge. It's vidya. And that's why the focus in the Upanishads is not so much on faith. Faith is important, but our focus here is not so much on faith as it is with jnanam, knowledge. That knowledge can't be shaken. Even when that guy is chasing after you with, you can just imagine, the enlightened person is really running fast, but this wisdom is with them all the time. Maybe the wisdom helps them run faster. They'll be a little bit less tense. I guess they say when you're tense, your body doesn't perform as well. So the enlightened person will be a little bit more relaxed as he or she runs away from the mugger. So, nabibheti kutaha cha, kutashchana iti. There's nothing from which that person should fear. Then it continues. Etam ha vava natapati. Natapati etam. That person who knows Brahman, ha vava, indeed, natapati would not be afflicted. Wouldn't be afflicted by what? And what's not afflicting the person is what's discussed here in the last part. We'll find out what else doesn't afflict. Person's not afflicted by fear, and now it continues. Also, natapati, not afflicted by, we're going to see, by punya and karma, by punya and papa, is what's discussed here. Repeat after me, please. Kimahagasadhuaknakaravam, kimahagasadhunakaravam, kimaham papamakaravamiti, kimaham papamakaravamiti, saya evam vidvanete, saya evam vidvanete, atmanagasprinute, atmanagasprinute, ubhe hye vaisha, ubhe hye vaisha, ete hatmanagasprinute, ete hatmanagasprinute, yahevam veda, yahevam veda, ityupanishata, ityupanishata. Prior statement said, such a person, etam, natapati, is not afflicted. Is not afflicted by what? And two very typical thoughts. Kim, why, aham, I, sadhu, good things, na akaravam, why didn't I do good things? Why didn't I do good things? And on the other hand, kim, why, aham, I, papam akaravam. Why did I do wrong things? Why did I not do good things, punya karmas? Why did I do papa karmas? This is a very common expression of regret. So sometimes we have regret at various times of our lives. Imagine towards the end of your life. Imagine perhaps on the final day of your life, taking stock, as it were, of how you lived. Look back on all of the things we've done, all of our experiences, and all of our mistakes. It'd be pretty easy to ask these questions. Why did I not do more good things? Why did I do all those silly things, all those wrong things? Why? That kind of thinking could stick for several reasons. One reason of which is, as you get ready to leave this life, you get ready for the next life. And according to our doctrine of karma, your next life is molded in part by your actions in this life, which means your punya and papa karmas in this life can determine what's going to unfold in your next life. Therefore, the person who's leaving this life might think, oh gosh, you know, it's a little bit like those of you who are getting ready for retirement. And how much money did you set aside? And then you look back on all your work days and think, oh, why didn't I set more aside, or whatever it is. It's that same kind of regret, knowing that whatever you've set aside is going to affect you in the future. That's true for your retirement accounts, and it's true with regard to punya and papa karmas. Now, this concern over punya and papa karma is something that afflicts, and that's the word that he used, tapati. It afflicts most people, especially our friends who follow biblical traditions, who believe that, you know, based on their good and bad deeds, they're going to be judged at the end of time. And based on that judgment, they could possibly go to hell for eternity. There's no second chance. A hell of an eternity of hell. Just because in their worldview, there's only one birth, one this life followed by an eternity in heaven or an eternity in hell. Do you think such a person might worry at the end of their lives about what good, in fact, not just at the end of their lives, every day of their life, they can go on worrying. And so too the Hindu, even though the belief system in the Hindu tradition is not of one life, but of many lives, the Hindu too can worry, and sometimes too much worry about, oh, what's going to happen because of all the bad deeds I've done. Here is, we're talking about the enlightened person. And the enlightened person not only has nothing to be afraid of, but also the enlightened person is not going to be tortured by this concern about punya and papa karmas from the past. Now, why would the enlightened person not be very concerned? Well, again, an outcome of the doctrine of karma, and this is not the time for a big, long explanation of the doctrine of karma, but for an enlightened person, there's no more rebirth. So who cares? This is it. The enlightened person will live out his or her prarabdha karmas in this life, and then because the owner of all those punya and papa karmas has been destroyed, the ahankara, the owner, the doer of the actions, the owner of the results has been destroyed with the fire of knowledge. And this is a big topic that's not appropriate right here. But that person then becomes freed from the future effects of karma. Therefore, there's no rebirth for that enlightened person. So why would that enlightened person fear these punya and papa karmas? Not at all. We're talking about the inner freedom then the enlightened person enjoys. Saha yaha evam vidwan. And a person who understands in this way, ete atmanam sprinute. The person who understands ete, these two, who understands the punya and papa karmas, that person, atmanam sprinute. And there are several meanings of sprinute. Sri Shankara gives balayati, strengthens. prinoti, balayati, he says, strengthens oneself, which means if you understand these two properly, these two are punya and papa, ete, these two. One who understands punya and papa properly, then you understand it can't afflict yourself. Atmanam means oneself. Doesn't mean Satchidananda here. It simply means oneself. So therefore, atmanam sprinute. Oneself becomes stronger in the sense that you're no longer afflicted by this concern about punya and papa. Ubhehi eva. Both of these indeed, eshaha ete, both of these two indeed, eshaha, this person, atmanam sprinute, understanding both of these, punya and papa, this eshaha, such a person who understands them, atmanam sprinute, becomes stronger, becomes free from affliction, free from worry. I've always noticed, pardon me just for thinking about my guru again, you know, at almost 80 years of age, with a long and demanding life, you look at his face, look at his forehead, and see if you can find any lines on that forehead. I'm just boggled by that. With tremendous demand on him at every phase in his life, and a very challenging, always teaching and traveling and a lot of responsibility. You all know the responsibility of, most of you have the responsibility as family people. His family, as it were, spans pretty much every continent on this planet. Wherever he goes, there's a queue of people anxious to tell him all their problems and get his advice. They're all family for him. Wherever he goes, this is what he encounters. So he has more responsibilities than you could even imagine. And he goes through all of that absolutely wrinkle-free. This is what's described here at the end of the second Bali, is a person who has such inner freedom that there's no worry, there's no stress, there's no concern, which means it's a life of inner freedom. And when there's freedom inside, then that freedom gets expressed. Such a person obviously is going to be more loving, more caring, and certainly not driven by self-serving agendas, but that person is then available to help you. So this is the inner freedom of the enlightened person. Yaha evam veda, and it comes for a person who understands in this way. Evam veda. In what way? In the way unfolded through this entire second valley, because this is the end of the second valley. So someone who has used these Upanishadic teachings in the second valley to discover their true nature, discover what is Brahman, to discover the non-separation between their true nature and Brahman, yaha evam veda, one who understands thus, is the one who enjoys his freedom. Iti thus Upanishad. Thus is this Upanishad, this valley, the second valley of the Upanishad. And it's really the second valley that contains the most powerful teachings, the teachings that we see quoted again and again and again.